This is The Gay Life on KSAN. Hi, I'm Randy Alfred, and this morning we have a show dealing entirely with health. Later, we'll be talking to Dr. Michael Sand, who's the Chief Venereal Disease Control Officer of the San Francisco City Clinic. And our first guests on The Gay Life this morning are Dr. David Kessler, who is the President, and Dr. Bill Owen, who is the Secretary of the Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights. Good morning.
Good morning, Randy.
Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights was founded when and why was it founded?
Well, it was founded in 1977, in July, actually, of 1977, about a month after prominence of Anita Bryant in the news when she basically won an election which overturned an existing gay rights ordinance in Dade County, Miami, Florida. People throughout the country, particularly in the gay community, and physicians among them, were very upset about that. And I think you can probably date the founding of a lot of organizations to that time, that period of time.
That's true, but a lot of them faded away very rapidly. There was a flush of unity and activism. The Coalition for Human Rights strikes me as one example, and the Human Rights Foundation, which doesn't seem to have been very active recently. Bay Area Physicians continues and thrives.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really true. I think there are probably several reasons for that. In addition to our support for human rights for gay people, and we have been very actively involved in this over the years, including sending speakers out to campaign for the No on 6 vote to overturn or to vote against Proposition 6, which was proposed a couple years ago in California, to many other things. We have basically kept the purpose of our organization multifold. We've been able to serve as to have our social concerns on the one hand, but also to serve as an educational organization to go out and talk to gay people and to physicians about gay health problems. We've also served as a support group to physicians who are gay many times don't feel completely at home within the straight medical societies and in social organizations of straight physicians, and so we've served a social purpose also for our gay physician members.
How many members do you have now?
Well, currently we have over 300,
and those are located all around the Bay?
These are located primarily in the Bay Area. A few physicians are outside the Bay Area. Particularly, it's interesting that we have a few in some small towns throughout the country, people who have written to us and said that they're gay and they have no other outlet in terms of relating to other gay physicians, and ask if they could join and receive our monthly journal newsletter.
But it's not just the city of San Francisco. There are gay physicians in Palo Alto or San Jose.
Yeah, exactly.
And now there are other gay physicians groups forming in other parts of the country. There's a very active group now in Los Angeles. There's one in Philadelphia. There are other groups in Chicago, Seattle, Denver, various places in Canada as well. So this is kind of something that's caught on. It's now sort of franchising.
Most of them are called Physicians for Human Rights also?
Or something like that. One or another title like that, yes.
Is there any national network of them yet?
No, not as yet, but as a matter of fact, that's one thing we're thinking of trying to put together in June at the time that there will be a national gay health conference here in San Francisco. We hope to be able to put together a national gay health doctors organization.
You mentioned it acting as a support group for physicians. What kind of problems do gay physicians face in coming out of the closet that are unique to that profession?
Well, I don't think that the problems are exactly unique to the profession. I think that in any profession, really, where you're dealing with a heterosexual majority, that and particularly with the attitudes that have been ingrained in people about homosexuality throughout the years, that there is going to be perhaps some resentment and some degree of discomfort with the whole notion of living a gay lifestyle.
There are a couple of other things that come to mind. You know, doctors are licensed by society to have access to other people's bodies. Now, people accept that, but when they have to think about a gay doctor doing something to their bodies, there may be some second thoughts that people have about that. They may not be quite so comfortable. So I think it takes some kind of courage for a gay doctor to come out as gay. Doctors are licensed by the state to practice. That license could be taken away for such issues as moral turpitude or who knows what all. I mean, somebody could raise the issue of morality or appropriateness, for example, of a pediatrician being gay. Would that gay pediatrician do something harmful to some child who's a patient?
But aren't half of most heterosexual pediatricians patients of the opposite sex?
Yes, that's true. And there, of course, there have been lots of problems involved in that, as everybody's aware. But when homosexuality is a buzzword. People get very emotional as soon as that issue or that word is raised, and sometimes reason or logic flies out the window. People just have a kind of knee-jerk reaction in a negative sense. Then, too, doctors have a lot to lose. They, by and large, do well in society in economic terms and status and prestige terms. And many of them sort of ask themselves, well, why should I take a chance of giving all that up by coming out and being recognized as a gay physician? Because I might have a lot to lose.
Do you know of any recent examples of licenses being lifted for the reason of people being gay or of licenses not being granted?
I do know. I don't know if I know of that specifically, but I do know of physicians not being admitted to training programs, for example, for which they were otherwise well qualified. As soon as it became known that they were gay, they were not allowed into the training program. Similarly, with staff positions in hospitals or partnerships in medical groups of one sort or another. We know of instances, we're collecting quite a few now, in which when it became public knowledge that the physician was gay, he was either not given hospital privileges or not allowed into that particular medical partnership, just on the basis, we think, of his being gay or her being gay.
We've had information from other health professions, too. For instance, dentists in at least one Rocky Mountain state whose licenses have apparently been lifted because their homosexuality became known. This is in states where homosexual acts are still considered to be criminal, too. We haven't gotten any letters about physicians recently, though.
Does your group include dentists or... There's a separate group now, isn't
right.
there?
Yeah, there's a group called Northern California Dentists for Human Rights, and inspired by Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights, the dentists got together and formed an organization which now numbers over 70 or 80 people, and they have monthly meetings as well and have many of the same support functions for their group that BAFR has for physicians.
The whole issue of physicians not being licensed or being licensed. There are cases, however, of people who've told the state licensing board that they were gay and who got their license, so that there doesn't seem to be any direct problem like that. The kind of thing which you just described, Dr. Kessler, reminds me of the way medical practices seem always to have been almost segregated on ethnic lines, where there would be four Irish doctors practicing in one office and three Jewish doctors practicing in another office, and hospitals that might be primarily Jewish or primarily WASP or so forth. That's kind of hard to get at as a form of discrimination because people can claim that they need a certain kind of rapport with their professional colleagues and so forth. Is there any way of attacking that legally, or does it have to be done through education?
Well, I think you're right. It is a much more subtle kind of discrimination and prejudice. And I think we do have to leave room for individuals making private contracts and working with people they get along with. I do believe in that. On the other hand, we do have to make sure as much as we can that people have equal access to economic opportunities, to training opportunities, and so on. I think there's legislation that would be of help in this area, And I think even more basic than that, although I'm not sure we can wait that long, is to try to deal with the general attitudes that people have about homosexuality, about homosexuals, and so forth. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, fear, disgust, hate, avoidance of the whole issue by the general public.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and we're talking to Dr. Bill Owen and Dr. David Kessler of the Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights. Your educational function seems to have a lot of directions it has to go in. You have to deal with the homophobia of straight doctors. You would have to deal with medical school admissions and other training programs. There are the medical associations. And then you also have to deal with the lay people within the gay community to deal with, I suppose there are health problems, I can think of health problems, that are more common in the gay community than outside, in which people need health education in. How do you deal with such a multiplicity of, it seems almost now like, how did we go until 1977 without a group of gay doctors? And aren't you overloaded with all of this?
Well, we have a lot of projects that are currently underway. But you're right, education is a major, very important function of BAFR. And one way that we're dealing with this is through a speakers bureau. For instance, with the gay community, we send out speakers to various gay community groups and to speak about sexually transmitted diseases. We have also sent out members of our speakers bureau to various hospitals and to medical schools to speak about those problems, as well as about the whole problem of the clinical approach to the homosexual patient. Dave and some of our other members have also gone to national meetings of various specialties, including the American College of Physicians, the internal medicine organization. And I think Dave will probably mention later about the American Psychiatric Association, which he'll be speaking at in May.
Okay. Before we go any further, why don't you give us the number of the Speakers Bureau, and then we'll also give it again at the end of the show.
Okay. The organizational number for Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights and any information about BAFR, including the Speakers Bureau, may be reached at this number, is area code 415-673-3189.
Okay. That's area 415-673-3189, and we'll repeat that again at the end of the show. Dr. Kessler, you were about to respond to the whole question about education.
Well, you're quite right. I mean, the number of jobs that are available for us to undertake is they're numberless. First, Bill was talking a little bit about how we try to spread some information up to the consumers of health care. We have columns now, health columns running in some of the gay newspapers. We'll be participating in a health fair that'll be held here in San Francisco shortly, as we have in the past years as well. With respect to professional education, Bill's already touched on some of the things that we do in terms of giving information. First of all, there are two parts of it. I think the health professionals need information, which they've never gotten. I, for example, in medical school, never learned a thing about homosexuality that was worth anything. And I'm not sure the situation is very much better today in medical schools either.
I've heard it said that medical schools, in fact, have a woeful lack of information about sexuality generally.
You're quite right. The programs in human sexuality training in medical schools are horrible. If the public knew how little physicians learn about human sexuality and the treatment of sexual dysfunction, I think they might be amazed. It was true, but 5 or 10 years ago, there were more programs in medical schools and better programs in this sort of training. But funds have been cut, and medical schools generally don't think too highly of the whole topic of sexuality. So apparently they're only too happy to cut that segment out of the curriculum. So the fact of the matter is that today there are very few medical schools around the country that have anything like an adequate training program, even in human sexuality, much less homosexuality. But of course, homosexuality is more than just sexuality. There's a lot more to it than that. And in terms of the kinds of medical problems and psychiatric issues that arise, My own view is that the training that health professionals get is very inadequate. So we have a lot to do, not that our organization by itself can undertake all that training, but through our contacts with medical societies, with the National Psychiatric Society, with the American Association of Medical Colleges, and so on, with our contacts with other professional groups, we hope at least to alert them to the needs in this area.
So does that mean that you're doing panels at professional meetings? And
exactly. For example, at the upcoming convention of the American Psychiatric Association that's going to be held here in San Francisco.
Which you are a member?
Of which I'm a member of the American Psychiatric Association, yes. We have a gay caucus of members of the American Psychiatric Association, and that gay caucus will be presenting several panels at that convention. We'll be participating in other informational programs during that convention. We'll be having a booth in the scientific exhibit section, which again hopefully will shed some light on the subject to our fellow psychiatrists and so forth. I mean, this is one way in which we can help give information, but also begin to help to change people's attitude, because that's really the other part of what we have to do. People will not learn, they won't even look for information that's available if they're too embarrassed, frightened, or disgusted about the subject matter to care about it. And if we can present ourselves and the subject matter as something that they don't need to be so frightened of, disgusted about, or need to avoid so much, maybe then they'll be able to pay attention to the information that is available that would help them be better physicians and provide better health care.
Another area of professional education that we've been getting into is through a publication of articles about these topics in some of the major medical journals. Dave and I did one in the journal called Medical Economics last year on what the straight physician should know to treat gays. And we also flew to Chicago last October and did a very extensive roundtable discussion on the whole topic of homosexuality and sexually transmitted diseases with a number of straight physicians who had flown in from throughout the country as well. This is going to be published in Patient Care later. And also, I personally am working on a couple articles for the Annals of Internal Medicine.
Was that group in Chicago a particular type of medical doctors or particular specialists?
No, it was actually very diverse. It included some family practitioners, a couple of psychiatrists, internists, obstetrician and gynecologist, even a pediatrician specializing in adolescent medicine.
What did you say to the straight physicians about what they should know about treating gay patients?
Well, we basically outlined what a lot of the problems are, particularly in the area of sexually transmitted diseases in gay people. And I think also went into the clinical approach to the gay patient, basically emphasizing that it is really important for the physician to know the sexuality of his or her patients, that this bears a lot on the types of conditions that he or she might consider in treating the patient. And developing a rapport and including questions on sexuality as part of a total medical evaluation is very important for the physician to do. It's surprising that a lot of physicians in the rest of the country really never get into the matter of sexuality with their patients, and yet those same patients may be coming out to San Francisco and on vacation or whatever and picking up certain conditions that their physicians back home might not know how to treat unless they have the key information that these patients are at risk for developing these particular conditions.
I think, too, just the opportunity for these doctors to talk about these issues and to talk with other gay doctors about this is a new experience for them, because I dare say for most doctors, the only time the topic of homosexuality comes up, or predominantly the major time it comes up, is in terms of faggot jokes or something like that. I don't think there are very many doctors in this country that actually have been able to sit down and meet with and talk to another gay doctor as a medical colleague discussing some professional issues. I think that's very important for more and more gay doctors to come out and make themselves visible so that the medical profession can begin to feel more comfortable in discussing and dealing with these issues and these people.
What, for instance, can you do about the doctor who's faced, say he's in middle America somewhere, with a 15-year-old patient who's part of a family that he's treating, who comes in and wants to talk to him about feelings he has towards other boys or other men? It would seem to me that that doctor, what does he do? Most doctors, it would seem to me, probably would want to send him to a psychiatrist just on the basis of hearing that that was there, despite the declassification of homosexuality as a disease. How do you reach that doctor?
Well,
what journals does he read?
Well, we have to try to get our message into as many journals as possible. Not only the very sub-specialized journals, such as the psychiatric journals, but the kinds of journals that Bill was just talking about, that will reach and will be read by the average doctor in practice, who doesn't necessarily have a lot of time and doesn't necessarily have the expertise in psychiatry or any other specialty, but is faced day in and day out with a whole barrage of different kinds of problems that he somehow has to deal with and can't always refer out to a specialist. How do you reach a doctor like that who probably in his medical school training had little or no information offered to him on the subject? How do you begin to deal with his attitudes as well as with his general lack of information? I think this is one of the jobs that a group such as ours is trying to tackle by these various means, at least to begin to raise the issue, raise the subject matter, and indicate that doctors are not necessarily very well prepared yet at this point to deal with a lot of these subjects. Even that can be of help. If we give doctors permission not to deal with some of these issues themselves, if they don't know anything about it or don't feel comfortable about it, sometimes they can do less harm if they don't get involved and do refer the person, their patient, to someone else who feels more comfortable or more knowledgeable. Doctors don't have to feel they have to be experts in everything. That's a negative approach to it, but that certainly is one way to look at it.
So to those doctors, you just want to make sure that they'll be non-judgmental in their response and give the patient an appropriate referral.
If they can at least do that, then they've already performed quite an important service.
Other than telling the poor kid to, well, go take a lot of cold showers and whatever it is that high school coaches always used to say.
Or you'll grow out of it, or just one sexual experience with a member of the opposite sex will take care of the whole thing, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you ever receive, as an organization, or do you know of individual doctors who have had patients, gay patients, come in and complain about homophobic or directly anti-gay treatment that they've received at the hands of other physicians? And what do you do about that?
Well, in terms of specific instances, recently we haven't been getting too many letters, but it's interesting that BAFR completed a survey, which was done during the 1978 Gay Freedom Day parade and also during the Castro Street Fair in August 1978. And approximately 576, I think it was, people were surveyed about their past medical responses from physicians. I think of the sample, something like 85% were gay and another 9% were bisexual. So it was primarily a gay sample. And of those people, over 20% had negative responses from physicians when they told their physicians that they were gay. Now, interestingly, of the lesbians that participated that answered the questionnaire, over 31% had negative responses, too. So you see, it's a problem not only with gay men, but also with lesbian patients. We have been trying to address this problem too, in terms of just bringing up the fact that that physicians do give negative reactions to patients. Not only a directly negative response in terms of verbalizing something, but through body language, for instance. Physicians, if a patient told them that they were gay, if a physician backs off or shrugs his shoulder or turns up his nose or something like that, it's kind of obvious to the gay patient who has learned throughout his or her life to pick up signals that he is getting a negative response.
It's not just individual doctors, but a kind of whole medical bureaucracy can come down on a gay person. For example, I got a letter a while back from an 18-year-old boy in a Midwestern state who told me that he had felt himself to be gay for some period of time. He'd come out to his parents. They were very upset about this, dragged him off to the family doctor, who sent him on to a psychiatrist, who immediately clapped him into a mental hospital. And this boy wrote to me from that mental hospital saying that he'd been committed there because of his homosexuality, that his psychiatrist there at the hospital was trying to change him, although the boy was telling the doctor that he didn't want to be changed, and he was comfortable with his homosexuality, but his parents weren't, and the small town they lived in, other people were not as well. They were not comfortable. And there he was, stuck in this mental hospital, and he had no idea of how long he would have to remain there or what he could do, and he felt that nobody there really understood his position or his point of view. And, you'd think this kind of horror story wouldn't be occurring any longer in the United States of America in the 20th century, but it is.
I have two questions about that story. One, how did the boy hear about you and get your address? And two, what were you able to do, if anything?
Okay. He heard about me or heard about the organization, I think, through some of the publicity that we've had. The organization and some of the officers have been featured in national magazines, for example, or on various TV shows and so forth. And I think the word has begun to get out that there are gay doctors and there's an organization of gay doctors and so forth. So that's how he heard about me. With respect to this specific instance, I wrote back to this fellow at the hospital. I have not yet gotten a response back from him, so I don't know where the situation stands at this particular time.
But if he's a minor, ultimately there's nothing that could be done in a legal sense, can there?
Well, here again, we're in touch, of course, with the gay rights advocates and other public interest gay law firms. And if there's something appropriate legally that could be done, we'd be prepared to ask for some legal assistance. So there is a kind of network now that I think makes it possible for us to try to take some action, try to help somebody like this young man who seems to be in quite a pickle there in that hospital.
Have either of you heard of any examples of straight doctors mistreating gay patients in a way that seems to you really should be the subject of some discipline on the part of a medical association? Are there any cases that are that blatant where the homophobia becomes unprofessional, actionably unprofessional?
Well, I haven't really received any information on those specific instances recently, but I'm sure that they're out there. You know, even the we do hear about things which may be more minor in terms of perhaps not warranting revocation of licensure or something like that, but still, I think, very significant to the patients who are involved. For instance, the case of the lesbian patient who goes in to see her gynecologist, and the gynecologist asks her if she is sexually active, and she replies, yes, I am. And he says, well, are you taking any contraceptives? And she says, well, no, I'm not. And so he said, well, then here, make sure you take one of these every day. And he writes out a prescription for birth control pills and gives it to her. Whereupon, after she leaves the office, she just laughs and tears it up. But, conceivably, birth control pills have a lot of side effects, too, in terms of clots forming in the legs and breaking off and going to the lungs. And if someone were to take this and have one of these adverse reactions and not really have to take it, then certainly that would be cause for disciplinary action, I would think.
I think some questions could be raised, for example, about some kinds of psychiatric practice with gay patients. What I have in mind is the sort of procedure in which a gay patient goes to a psychiatrist feeling some kind of distress, and the psychiatrist sort of goes along meeting with the patient to sort of gain the patient, get some good rapport and establish a good relationship with the patient, but not putting the psychiatrist's agenda on the table, which may often be the psychiatrist's wish to convert that patient's sexual orientation from gay to non-gay. I think there ought to be more of a kind of sort of a truth in lending law or some kind of informed consent. You know, the consumer should be more protected. If I go to buy an automobile, I want to know, you know, how this automobile works and what the experience has been. And it seems to me that patients going to doctors, and especially going to psychiatrists, should be encouraged to ask what the psychiatrist's point of view is about, for example, homosexuality, what the psychiatrist's agenda is, what the psychiatrist's experience and training and attitudes are with respect to the to these issues, so that as a patient, one shouldn't have to wake up 3 months or 6 months down the line and find out that the psychiatrist has really, in a subtle way, been trying to influence or change your sexual orientation when that's not what you had in mind when you went to see that psychiatrist.
Truth and therapy laws.
Truth and therapy. That's right. Need a Ralph Nader.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and we're talking to Dr. David Kessler and Dr. Bill Owen of the Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights. There seem to be two areas in which gay people have their own sets of health problems. One involves communicable diseases, especially among gay men, and I think another is involves the use of recreational drugs. Alcohol, poppers, MDA, I think, are probably the most commonly identified with the gay community. You mentioned articles that have been written in the various gay newspapers. There was a whole sequence on alcohol as a medical problem in the gay community. How does that differ from alcoholism problems in the mainstream?
Well, I think that alcohol is probably a major problem within the gay community because many of our social centers are basically focused upon the bar scene, and in order to meet someone, the social setting requires or has until probably fairly recently that you go into a bar and buy a drink and spend the evening perhaps drinking with someone else or looking for someone to drink with. And I think as a result of this, it has created a fairly high percentage of high incidence of alcoholism particularly among gay males. But also I understand it's a problem among lesbians too.
What about poppers and MDA? Are those safe drugs? Or?
Well, poppers or amyl nitrite, or as the commercial product is known, it's called isobutyl nitrite, is a substance that is related to nitroglycerin, which is used by heart patients. Formerly it was prescribed as, it still is actually, can be prescribed as a drug to which dilates the blood vessels. It doesn't do this specifically in the heart. It dilates blood vessels throughout the body. This results in a fall in the blood pressure, which the fall in the blood pressure to the brain results in a rush, as it were. That's how that name developed. One of the commercial products, and a sense of euphoria, giddiness during that period of time, occasionally skipping beats of the heart while the low pressure is going on. In people who are relatively healthy in terms of their cardiovascular function and their response to the sudden blood pressure drop, there probably aren't too many problems. The problem is, though, with people who have underlying heart disease or blood pressure problems, the sudden drop in pressure could result in conceivably in heart attacks or in strokes and other sorts of cardiovascular insults. In addition to that, the commercial products, which are often used, really have no regulation by shall we say, the Food and Drug Administration in terms of the purity of the products. And we don't really know if there are any impurities in these substances and if there are, what the impurities might be doing in terms of either short-term or long-range health problems. We hear stories, for instance, of people after using these complaining of developing asthma-like symptoms. And this hasn't really been well reported in the medical literature. But it does raise the question of whether perhaps the impurities in the commercial products may be doing this.
What about communicable diseases? Is everything from the old standards of gonorrhea to all kinds of new intestinal parasites and so forth? And is there any mechanism of direct cooperation between gay physicians who are more likely to see these, those who have gay practices first, and local health departments or National Center for Disease Control in Atlanta? That is, if the doctor in St. Louis has a patient who's returned from New York or San Francisco or Key West with some unusual disease, and he's enlightened and he knows about the sexuality of his patient and suspects that that might be what's there, if he were to call Atlanta and try to find something out about it, would they have information on hand?
Well, we're getting to the point, hopefully, where this will happen. The current director of the Center for Disease Control Venereal Disease Division, Dr. Paul Wiesner, is very interested in the whole problem of sexually transmitted diseases in the gay community, since it apparently forms a fairly large part of sexually transmitted diseases in the United States. And he, in fact, is advertising now for a position, for a physician or whoever, to be a liaison with the CDC in Atlanta and to be able to travel throughout the United States and develop relationships with the various gay clinics and with private gay physicians in the major cities in the United States to spread the word about diseases which are currently problems and to try to get some new ideas about approaching them in terms of diagnosis and treatment. By the way, Dr. Wiesner will be speaking in June at the National Gay Health Conference, which is sponsored by National Lesbian and Gay Health Coalition. This is an organization comprised of various health groups, including the American Psychiatric Association, the Medical Student Gay Organization, the American Public Health Association, various groups that have gay caucuses, which are interested in the whole problem of gay health. And this, their third national annual conference is going to be here in San Francisco this year on June 19th through June 22nd.
Right. We've done some announcements of that and we'll continue to do them. And when it occurs, we hope to bring some tape panels and discussions on the air. Do either of you see a time or a point at which those gay doctors who are in essentially gay practices of treating almost all gay patients and frequently located in or near gay neighborhoods will start some kind of journal of gay medicine, or will it become a recognized specialty? Is there a need for that down the road somewhere?
Well, I think that there is. In fact, BAFR for the last year and quarter has been putting out a journal or a newsletter called BAFRON. We have been reporting in here some of the latest developments in particularly in sexually transmitted diseases throughout the world literature. We've been looking into various British journals and New Zealand journals, actually journals anywhere throughout the world that have had articles which are relevant to this problem. And we hope that perhaps we'll be getting some original articles published in there, too. BAFRON has national circulation, and it's received by many of the gay community and gay health organizations throughout the U.S.
So that's more than an organizational newsletter. It has medical information in it.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Before we close, is there anything that either of you wanted to say that none of my questions have covered?
Well, I suppose overall in summary, I would say that I think we've come a long way in a very few years in terms of the gay community in general, and certainly in terms of the doctors group and the kinds of things we've been able to do. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of that important fact. However, San Francisco is not the United States, and the United States, I guess, is not the world. You don't have to go very far out of San Francisco I happen to be in Pittsburgh. That's Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That is kind of far away from San Francisco. But, for example, you think a large city like Pittsburgh, there'd be lots of gay organizations and gay groups and gay doctors and so forth. Uh-uh. There aren't. People are very frightened, feel very vulnerable in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and you don't have anything like, by no stretch of the imagination, do you have the kind of gay activity, gay groups, gay organizations in a city like Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I think, in a sense, we're very fortunate that we live in San Francisco and we can do the kinds of things we're doing here. But we have a lot of work to do to get similar groups going and similar activities going around the country, much less in other countries of the world.
Dr. Owen?
Well, I just wanted to thank you for inviting us to be on your show and remind the listeners that if they would like to reach us about BAFR or about we have a physician referral service, for example, that lists a number of physicians, both gay and non-gay, who have basically said that they can relate well to and understand medical problems of gay patients.
Grab a pencil and paper. You're going to hear a phone number.
That they may call us. The phone number is area code 415-673-3189.
That's area 415-673-3189. And the box number?
Our post office box number is P.O. Box 14546, San Francisco, CA 94114.
That's box 14546, San Francisco, 94114 for the Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights. And thank you very much, Dr. Bill Owen and Dr. David Kessler of the Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights, for being our guests on The Gay Life this morning.
Thank you very much, Randy, for having us.
Thank you, Randy.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and our next guest this morning is Dr. Michael Sands, who's chief of VD control with the San Francisco City Clinic, which is part of the Department of Health. Good morning, Dr. Sands.
Good morning. How are you?
April is VD Awareness Month. What does that mean in terms of what actually happens around it?
Okay. The mayor, Dianne Feinstein, has, I guess you'd call it, ordained April as a month that the city should be aware of venereal disease problems. The San Francisco City Clinic, which is the main venereal diseases clinic, actually the only venereal diseases clinic in the city of San Francisco, is actively participating in the Awareness Month via a number of mechanisms. One is that we are actively going out and increasing our screening activities. We are going out and doing bath screening now to look for men that have asymptomatic gonorrhea or syphilis. We are going out and putting a mobile van, which is a screening van, out in a number of additional sites for this month. We're trying to publicize the fact that San Francisco has very high rates of venereal disease, probably the highest in the country, and that we want our citizens of San Francisco to be aware of these high rates and aware of the fact that people, regardless of whether they're symptomatic, should get periodically screened for venereal diseases. We're having a number of minor activities. We're having a little baseball game with one of the radio stations as a little publicity stunt. Basically, it's a month to heighten the awareness of the citizens of San Francisco that venereal diseases are certainly a major health problem in the city.
Now, you've raised a number of interesting points. The bathhouse screening, for instance, and the mobile van are programs that go on year-round, so they're being stepped up for the month of April?
The mobile van is, yeah. The bathhouse, we're starting to look during the month of April for additional screening houses right now. The mobile van will be at two additional sites during April. Do you want specifics or?
Sure. Why don't you,
okay,
give them now? And throughout the month of April, we'll continue to give public service announcements as
great.
We do year-round. But grab a pencil and paper, people, and you can find out where the VD screening van is going to
okay.
be.
Okay. The mobile van will be on April 15th at 18th and Castro between 11:30 and 1:30, and on April 29th at Polk and California at the same time, so between 11:30 and 1:30. And this will give men an opportunity to go in and have free of charge a rectal culture for gonorrhea and a blood test for syphilis.
So that's the 15th at 18th and Castro.
Right, and the 29th at Polk and California.
And they're both during lunchtime.
And they're both during lunch break. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned asymptomatic gonorrhea. That seems to be a special problem. What fraction of people who have gonorrhea don't have any symptoms whatever among gay men?
So. Among gay men, it's probably a very large percent. The asymptomatic gonorrheal carrier is probably the significant reservoir of gonorrhea in any population.
So someone who carries the germs but may not have any
carries
symptoms.
Carries the germs, may have no or minimal symptoms, and then can spread the gonorrhea organism and or later on become symptomatic from it. It's estimated that for rectal gonorrhea, probably anywhere between 60 and 80% of men that have culture-proven rectal gonorrhea have really no symptoms from it. For pharyngeal gonorrhea, it's predominantly an asymptomatic disease.
That's in the throat.
In the throat, yeah.
Okay. Now, a friend of mine who works with the Berkeley Gay Men's Health Collective said that over there in doing bathhouse testing, they found that one out of six people whom they tested in the bathhouse without symptoms had gonorrhea, mm-hmm. which would mean, for instance, that if that figure were to hold in other areas, that if you were in a bathhouse, you could count one, two, three, four, five, six,
and you would be the one.
The sixth person. One out of every six contacts mm-hmm. might be someone who would give that to you.
Yeah.
There's been something said about the new super strain of gonorrhea or thunderclap. What is this? Is that under control or not?
Yeah, it's under control. This was referring to the strains of gonorrhea that were penicillin resistant and emerged mainly during the time of the Vietnamese War. They are strains predominantly from the Far East. It really hasn't become a health problem, and particularly in San Francisco, we really haven't had any difficulty with it at all. I don't think there have been more than 15 cases in the last year, and there are adequate alternate drugs to penicillin that this can be cured. So it hasn't become a significant health problem.
You mentioned also that San Francisco has one of the highest, if not the highest, rates of venereal disease in the country. What's behind that? Is it just a lot of sexual activity? Or?
I think it's probably a mixture of things. One, I think it's a lot of sexual activity. The city is a city with a high singles population, and so, again, sexual activity. Probably the reporting here in San Francisco in terms of detecting cases and reporting cases is better than most cities. So it may be that we have just very, very good case detection and reporting rates, which would it would elevate the number over other cities. I would say it's a mixture of those things.
In other words, more of the cases actually come to
medical
attention.
More of the cases are actually detected and are named and are included in the statistics as opposed to cases that just go to private doctors and are never named and included in the statistics. So we have, I think, a little better statistics.
Okay. Also, these problems tend to be among gay men and among straight couples. So it seems to be that the most prevalent areas, the most prevalent populations for the venereal disease problem is among men or women who have sex with men, and that women who have sex with women, apparently there isn't as much of a problem, or else it doesn't show up in the statistics?
Yeah, right now the area of sexually transmitted diseases in the lesbian population is virtually unexplored. From the little that's known, it appears that lesbian women aren't at very high risk for acquiring any of the usual venereal diseases for gonorrhea, syphilis. There doesn't seem to be a high risk. But populations haven't been looked at for other of the sexually transmitted diseases like hepatitis B or amoeba or giardia. It hasn't been looked at, and I suspect that if it's looked at, then it may be found in a little higher incidence in the lesbian women population.
Right. When we talk about the traditional venereal diseases, if traditional is the right word, of gonorrhea and syphilis, that they seem to be spread by penetration.
Mm-hmm.
So that in a lesbian couple, for instance, there is much less chance of disease transmission. Mm-hmm. Now, you just mentioned a number of diseases. These are what's usually referred to now as STDs or sexually transmitted diseases.
Right. These are just included amongst the sexually transmitted diseases. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned hepatitis mm-hmm. as one. Would you include mononucleosis as an STD?
Potentially it can be sexually transmitted. Yeah, certainly people shed the mononucleosis virus, and so it can be transmitted sexually.
Well, that would also be true of hepatitis. There are those
hepatitis
Oakland
B,
cases
hepatitis
of
A.
Food carriers, for instance, can mm-hmm. I mean, food handlers can transmit.
Oh, food handlers traditionally too. Transmit hepatitis. Yeah.
So it's not always a sexually.
No, it's not strictly sexual. But
okay, maybe that's why it's sexually transmissible rather than sexually transmitted, because it can be transmitted sexually, but that's not the only form.
Right, there are alternate routes or alternate means.
Hepatitis is now at what kind of level in San Francisco? Has it reached a kind of a constant high level? Has it peaked, and what is?
Well,
there seemed to be an epidemic a couple years ago.
The only thing you can say is that there's plenty of hepatitis around. In terms of what level it's at, I'm not really sure. Certainly, we've conducted some blood screenings to see what percentage of the gay male population has had hepatitis in the past, what percentage of them are carrying virus, and what the acquisition rates are for hepatitis virus. And this is true not only in San Francisco, but in other major cities like Chicago, New York, St. Louis, where it's been looked at, something in the range of 60 to 70% of gay men have evidence of having had hepatitis in the past. They have antibody for hepatitis B. Another few percent are carrying the virus, and the rate of acquisition is somewhere in the range of 12% per year. So hepatitis B certainly exists in the community, and the chance of acquiring it seemed fairly high.
In other words, if you have not had hepatitis before, mm-hmm. your chances as a gay male of getting it in any 1 year are 1 in 8?
Probably, depending on your sexual activity. There are a number of other factors, things like number of partners, sexual practices in terms of orogenital or anal sexual activity. These things correlate with high acquisition of hepatitis B virus.
Now, when you say 60 or 70%, not all of those men presumably knew they had had hepatitis.
No, a good fraction of them can't really pinpoint an episode of clinical hepatitis. They never got yellow. They never got really sick from it.
So and they may have had what they thought was a flu.
Right, or a mild viral illness that was actually their hepatitis. Yeah.
Okay. Is it possible that in some cases what happened was they were exposed to a small enough amount they were inoculated in a sense, that they were given some kind of small case, and that given the dosage or their exposure coupled with some form of natural resistance, that they developed the antibodies without really having had a real case of it?
Sure. I think when you look at a good number of viruses, the usual course for most viruses is that they will give you very mild infections that a lot of times are unnoticed, or just a few days worth of fever, or basically just a flu kind of illness, and then the patient will develop antibodies. They'll become resistant to it. But the number of people that actually develop true hepatitis with the yellow eyes, you know, that are really laid out for any length of time, is probably small as compared to the total number of people that are exposed to the virus and develop immunity to it.
Okay. And that 12% acquisition rate was based on all cases, including the very mild
ones. Right.
What if people have had hepatitis, should they still be concerned about getting it again, or are they immune?
They are immune to the type of hepatitis virus that they've already had. Basically, there are three or more types of hepatitis virus. They're classed as hepatitis A virus, B virus, and non-A, non-B, which is probably a few other viruses. Once you've had hepatitis A, you're immune to hepatitis A. Once you've had hepatitis B, for the most part, most people are then immune to B. So you're immune to the specific virus that you've had, but you're not immune to – if you've had B, you're not immune to getting A if you haven't had it.
Okay. This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and we're talking to Dr. Michael Sands, who's the Chief Venereal Disease Control Officer of the San Francisco City Clinic. What about the other sexually transmitted diseases that you mentioned? I guess they're caused by
they're parasites. A broad number of organisms. Right now, one of the interests is in the sexually transmitted enteric diseases, the infections of bowel, basically. And there are a group of parasites that can cause it, mainly amoeba and giardia. And also there's sexually transmitted shigella, which is the organism that causes bacillary dysentery. And again, these organisms can be sexually transmitted. The highest risk folks are the people that engage in orogenital or anal sexual activities.
If someone thinks they have a symptom either of a venereal disease or a sexually transmitted disease, what course should they take?
I think the one simple thing to do is we have a very efficient venereal diseases clinic down at 250 4th Street. This is the city clinic.
Okay, and those who are living in the outlying counties
and it's open
can
to
also,
anyone.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a free open clinic.
Right, but also those who live in other areas can contact their county health departments.
Yeah, most places have local health departments that run venereal diseases clinics. The hours sometimes vary. But ours is a confidential, free venereal diseases service that can screen for gonorrhea and treat syphilis and will refer for things that are not within the scope of our clinic services.
And if you're a minor, you don't need parental consent?
As long as you're over 12 years old. Yeah,
okay.
By public health law, if you're over 12, you can come in and be treated for venereal disease with confidential treatment without your parental consent or knowledge.
So that shouldn't be something that deters people.
Right, absolutely.
It has in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
What else keeps people from seeking help when they need it?
Well, first I think is just recognizing that they need it, knowing where an agency is that will provide them, and probably third is just feeling comfortable about the type of services or the confidentiality of the services that are provided. I think those are probably the big deterrents to people. But I think once you recognize that there's something abnormal going on, that potentially you have a sexually transmitted or venereal disease, the next thing to do is to locate an agency. And again, the city clinic will provide free confidential services in a discreet manner so that I think most people, it's fairly comfortable to come down and be treated.
What about symptoms that go away?
Well, again, some of the venereal diseases will have symptoms that seem to occur and remit and occur again, particularly things like syphilis. If you sit and you watch your syphilis chancre for long enough, it's going to go away by itself. But you're still infectious for your syphilis, and if you wait long enough, you'll develop a secondary syphilis rash and progression of your syphilis.
Harder to treat.
Not all things – well, not necessarily harder to treat, but at least it's it's prolonged your infectivity. You've had a chance to expose more of your friends to syphilis, and it makes it a little bit more of a mess. It's still easy to treat, though. But I think that if anyone that has had a penile or rectal lesion, regardless of whether or not it's healed, if they haven't had a syphilis blood test in a while, should have an examination.
Gay men who are sexually active should be treated, should be tested how often on a routine basis?
Well, it depends on how active. If they're fairly sexually active and going to the baths, having a number of partners, probably every 2 months is a reasonable figure. If you're a monogamous gay man, then maybe every 4 to 6 months, depending on whether your partner is just strictly seeing you or whether you're seeing a number of outside partners.
And whether or not he's being tested.
And whether or not he's being tested, yeah. But every 2 months is a reasonable.
What if you're not sure if you have symptoms or not? Is there any phone number that people can call just to get information?
Sure. The City Clinic runs a hotline that will provide informational services during the day from, I think, 8:30 to 5, and after that has a 3-minute educational tape. The number for the hotline is 495-OGOD. It's just 495-OGOD. Yeah.
Okay. That's 495-OGOD for
right.
Venereal disease information.
Right.
And if you happen to call when it's not open and you get the tape, you can call back during the daytime
and
get specific questions.
Hours, or I think that you can leave a message on the tape and then we'll call you back.
Okay. They used to say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I suppose now it's a gram of prevention is worth a kilogram of cure. What's the best way to – right. It changes the ratio too, as we go metric. What's the best – what are some ways of avoiding venereal disease?
We are advocating the use of condoms. Condoms are, had in the past been relegated to a fairly minor position as a second-rate means of birth control for heterosexual populations. But the condom actually is a fairly effective way of protecting yourself against a number of sexually transmitted diseases, including gonorrhea, syphilis, herpes viruses. So the condom is certainly one mechanism. Other mechanisms are that, obviously you should make some attempt at knowing your sexual partner, knowing if your sexual partner has any problems, knowing if you're having any difficulties as far as changes in your health status. If you have a discharge, you should be examined for it. People recommend such things as post-coital voiding, to urinate after you've had intercourse. And this probably does something as far as flushing out the urethra and potentially getting rid of small numbers of bacteria and not allowing them to infect. These are basic basic preventative measures. So know your partner, understand what's going on with yourself in terms of your own body, and the use of condoms are probably three basic protective measures.
Basically, people should regard venereal disease and sexually transmitted diseases as health problems like any others,
yeah,
which they should treat, which they should take care of,
yeah,
and not regard with any sense of shame or evil or whatever it is that keeps people from – or stigma, which mm-hmm. keeps people from seeking treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of them are you know, gonorrhea, syphilis are very, very simple diseases to treat. They're certainly more easily treated than things like the common cold. And I don't think at this point in our society that these things should be stigmatized at all. I think it's just if you feel that you have something, you should be examined. And if you do, it's a simple matter to treat it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Sands, for being our guest on The Gay Life this morning.
Great. Enjoyed being here.
That about wraps it up on The Gay Life this morning. Our guests have been Dr. David Kessler and Dr. Bill Owen of the Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights and Dr. Michael Sands from the San Francisco City Clinic. This edition of The Gay Life has been engineered by Ern Morgan and produced by me, Randy Alfred. I also write two columns, Taking Sides and On Live, for The Sentinel, which is available in gay neighborhoods throughout San Francisco. If you're listening on Saturday morning, this show will be repeated late Sunday night at 1 a.m. So please tell a friend about The Gay Life on KSAN.